Okay, so we've been in the middle of a series of teachings on how to go from confusion to enlightenment, starting off from where we are, which isn't at the end of the path, the beginning, and about talking about our precious human life, all the opportunity that it affords, all the good qualities it has. And then the real purpose of our life and how difficult it is to attain, that we can really make use of this opportunity to tap into our Buddha potential, to reveal it, to make our lives meaningful for others. And yet this life doesn't last so long. It goes by very, very quickly. Remember when I was little, 1 year seemed like forever, you know, from one birthday to the next. Those presents just didn't come in fast enough, you know. But now as an adult, the years go very quickly. Very, very quickly. And death is the inevitable result of having taken birth. So death is something that we will face someday, that everybody faces, no way around it. But if we can prepare for it, then death need not be a frightening thing. It can be actually a blissful thing. So last week I was telling you the story of that one monk in Dharamsala who died, and how he was able to really relax and transform the whole death process into a way of understanding emptiness and generating the altruistic intention. And he died very wonderfully. So we have to look at our own lives and see if we've created the cause to die in a similar way or not. Because everything that happens in life doesn't happen accidentally. Things don't just happen out of nowhere. They happen due to causes. This is a very scientific thing. Things happen due to causes. So we have to examine the causes we've created, and that will give us an indication of what kind of things are likely to happen in the future. So at death time, what happens is our consciousness starts to separate from this body. You know, life is when the consciousness and the body are joined together, and dying is when they're starting to separate, and death is when that separation is complete, and then the consciousness goes on and takes another body, influenced, of course, by previous actions. So, this is really pointing to the thing that we are not our body. This is a big thing, especially for us Westerners, because we're so, like, attached to this body, and so much of our ego identity is wrapped up in this body. And yet, we really aren't our body. Our body changes moment to moment. When we think back about being a little kid, it's hard to even imagine what it was like having an infant's body. And it would be hard to imagine having a body that's 95 years old and a mind that's senile. And yet that's perfectly within the realm of possibility. You know, we aren't our body. The consciousness changes a lot depending on the body. And, you know, similarly, after death, when it takes another body, it will be influenced, you know, by the physical structure of that body as well. And so what body we take in the future lives depends on the causes that we've created before, either previous lives or this lifetime. And what karma ripens at the time of death that will throw us into another body depends also on causes. So at death time, it's not that, you know, the sum total of, you know, positive and negative actions are put on a scale and somebody says, okay, well, you're a bit on the heavy side, you know, you go down. There's nobody judging, there's nobody determining, okay? Nobody's running the show and punishing people. Things just happen due to causes and conditions. And so, likewise, things, the karma isn't added up, yeah? But rather, in one lifetime, we have many, many different kinds of karmic seeds. I mean, you can look at just one day, pick today. I mean, so many different thoughts, so many different actions. So we might have had some, you know, from the kind of thoughts we had, putting in one imprint, and then maybe you went to work and you got irritated or, you know, jealous of that somebody. So another imprint goes in. So just, you know, throughout the day, we're constantly acting mentally, physically, verbally, constantly leaving, you know, like energy traces or imprints on our mind stream from all the different actions we've done. Now, which of those are going to manifest and ripen at death time? You know, not all of them can. You know, certain ones will, and then they are the ones that will, like, by those seeds growing, you know, they will attract our body into a certain kind of life in a future lifetime. So the first kind of imprints that are very likely to ripen at death are from very powerful actions. So if we've done some very, very powerful action, even one time, you know. So, for example, they talk of five extremely negative actions, you know, like killing one's father or one's mother, or causing schism in the Sangha community, things like this. You know, so if one does a very heavy negative action, those things, you know, are the ones that manifest first. That, because it's so heavy, it's so weighty, it's so potent. Similarly, you know, if one does a very powerful positive action, it likewise has a good opportunity of being the foremost one to manifest or to start to ripen at the time of death. And so, for example, actions done in relationship to the triple gem, you know, because it's a powerful object, or actions we do with very, very strong altruism. Okay, things like this, you know, the very powerful positive actions, they could also be the first ones to manifest at death time. Okay, so first is like the powerful one. Now, if there's no kind of outstandingly powerful actions at death time, then the ones that are very likely to ripen are the ones that are more habitual. And you really see here how habit is a very, very important factor in the path, because just by the force of doing something habitually, it builds up a real weight in the mind. I mean, you can see it just with any habit you have now in this life. You know, I mean, very, very small habits, by the fact of doing them over and over again, they're very strong. They become difficult to break. So likewise, you know, for example, habitually getting angry, habitually lying, or habitually making offerings, habitually being kind. You know, whatever it is, it is a habitual action, that one, those also could be the next ones, if there's no strong or powerful ones, to ripen and throw us into the next rebirth. And what conditions a lot of the ripening of karma at death time is the thoughts that we have while we're dying. And this is a very, very important thing, you know, and you can kind of see that even now when we're awake, if our mind is calm and peaceful, things go better, even in our environment, our experience, than when our mind is turbulent. So similarly at death time, you know, if the mind is filled with clinging and attachment, not wanting to leave this life, clinging to relatives, you know, clinging to the body, or alternatively, if the mind is filled with anger, you know, anger at dying, anger at things that happened years ago, okay? If the mind is disturbed in that kind of way at the time of death, then that acts like the fertilizer so that the negative karmic seeds can grow, okay? So that's why we really say when somebody's dying or when we're dying, to try and keep them really, really peaceful and calm, not to generate attachment or aversion or anxiety in a person when they're dying. And this is why Dharma practice is especially important at death time, because if the mind is able to be in a very positive state, for example, if we can remember our teacher, if we can remember the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha at the time we die, if we can generate loving kindness, you know, if we can think about emptiness, then the mind is in a very positive state of mind, and that also is the fertilizer which encourages the ripening of previously created positive actions. Now, the next point we go into, you know, here in this sequence, is the meditation on the lower realms. And the reason this comes here is like we talked about the preciousness of life and then the inevitability of death, you know, and how to make our life meaningful. And then we have to consider, well, what kind of rebirth can we have after we die, you know, either an upper one or a lower one. Okay. Of course, we would all much rather like to think about upper rebirths and pleasure and, you know, having everything hunky-dory, but I think it's also good to be kind of realistic and like, well, what happens if things don't go so well? And if we really look at a lot of the karma we've created in this lifetime and really, you know, are very honest with ourselves, you know, has the amount of positive karma exceeded the amount of negative karma? So just in terms of, you know, if you were going to throw a lottery, which do you have more of, which is going to be more likely to ripen? You know, and if we really look and, you know, think about the different destructive actions and which ones we've done and which ones we've actually succeeded in abandoning, we might come to realize that, you know, because cause and effect works, there is a chance that we will take an unpleasant rebirth simply because we've created the cause for it. I know we all like to think about things that are beautiful and wonderful and everything. And we tend to block out things that we consider disagreeable. In other words, if something is nice, then I like to think about it and I believe it. And if it makes me feel uneasy inside, then I don't believe it. Okay, in other words, we're using as the criteria for what we believe and don't believe, whether we like it or not. Okay, that's not a real wise criteria to use to evaluate what exists and doesn't exist. Okay, because, you know, what we like and what we don't like isn't always such a good, reliable thing about evaluating things. It just shows our personal preferences, our mental blocks, and our biases. So we really have to, have a little bit of a courageous mind to examine the possibility of lower realms. This is one of the most difficult subjects to talk to Westerners about. Yeah, people completely freak out about this. This, and when you talk about sexual misconduct, those are the two things Westerners go bonkers of. Okay, so we've hit the big topic tonight. they told me Thang Rinpoche, who's an incredible lama, he was in Italy and he talked for 3 days about the lower realms, his first time in Europe. You know, he didn't know why everybody was freaking out and walking out of the teaching, you know. when we listen to this, you know, description of like lower realms of rebirth, we have to try and free ourselves from our Judaic Christian upbringing, because I find in teaching Westerners that's often one of the biggest blocks people have. Because again, we tend to look at Buddhism and project Christian meaning onto it. Yeah. And then we sometimes get quite confused. So it's important to remember when we're talking about this that lower rebirth is not a punishment. Okay? Nobody else sends us there. And it's not taught in order to make us afraid, and it's not taught in order to make us intimidated. Okay, so the question may come: well, why did the Buddha teach about, you know, unfortunate states of rebirth? You know, and people often say, well, maybe he's just doing it to try and scare us into being good. You know, and you can see very clearly how this is our Christian upbringing. Yeah? Kind of scare tactic to make us be good because we're naughty little kids and, you know, the boogeyman will come and get us if we take another sucker out of the cupboard. That the Buddha didn't need to teach us things to make us fearful and terrified. Yeah, I mean, there's enough fearful and terrifying things in our life. The Buddha doesn't need to teach about it. That's not why the Buddha taught about lower realms of rebirth. Okay, there's no purpose in our becoming terrified. Absolutely no purpose at all. Okay, the Buddha rather taught about this out of compassion, okay, out of his care for us, because he was able to see that within our mind streams there may exist the cause to take that kind of rebirth, and if we can learn about it beforehand, then we can purify that cause and we can stop creating war causes for it. Yeah? So it's like, you know, if a bomb is in your car and you don't know about it, somebody may come and tell you there's a bomb in your car. And if you say, oh, he's just telling me that to make me afraid, you know, I mean, what's going to happen? Whereas if you really realize the person's telling you this to warn you about something serious because they care, then you take action to do something about it. Okay? So similarly with this. And it's important also, in order to develop genuine love and compassion for all beings, which is something we really do want to do in our hearts, it's important to be able to reflect on their sufferings and on their misery. For example, the misery that they experience being born in unfortunate realms. Now, how can we be in touch with their misery of being born there if we don't want to even think about the existence of those realms or even acknowledge our own possibility of being born there? Okay, so you see, really, in order to tap into the pain that others experience so that we can generate genuine compassion for them, we have to also be willing to contemplate our own problems and sufferings. Very important. Okay? Otherwise, you know, love and compassion is just Pollyanna, goody-goody, smiling things, but we don't have any guts when it comes to looking at anything unpleasant. And if we have a weak mind like that, how can we possibly benefit others? Okay?